It's an absolute honour, to be fair. I've got a lot of respect for the man. And as many of you will know, last year he... I think, was it last year? Or was it the year before last? He came out in the papers. Last year, wasn't it? Yeah, so last year Simon went public with his experiences in, and it was reported in the newspapers. Some of that reporting was quite negative and was very, very typical of the media's portrayal of the subject and misunderstanding of it. Very, very sad to see, and I think he's a very brave man for going public in that way. So I'd like to hand over now to Simon, and we'll kickstart his presentation. Can you all please give him a very warm round of applause? Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. First of all, I'm delighted to be invited by the chairman, Dave Hodren. Dave's right, he was the first researcher that I approached. Earlier this year, I spoke at your sister organisation. I call it your sister organisation because you're in Birmingham, Birmingham Churches. And at the end of my talk, one of the audience came up to me and said, "It's the very first time I've ever met a real-life reptilian." And interestingly enough, I did a talk in Hull 3 days ago, 4 days ago, and the newspaper is the very first official media to use the R word. When I did the breakfast interview, I was asked to not talk about reptilians. Very interesting. Okay, my everlasting image from you will be that flying steak, I have to say. Right, we've only got 2 hours. We'll do as much as we can. We'll take questions at the end. Dave, you're going to have a break at some point, I presume.
If you want a break, I'll put it through your camera.
I don't need a break, but the guys might need one.
Yeah, okay.
So that's fine. That's fine. Okay. Tonight's talk is Illuminati. There will be elements of alien, off-world talk with it, but that's not the talk you've the chairman's booked tonight. This might be the only chance you ever get of actually talking to somebody who grew up in a real Illuminati family. Make it clear, I'm not a member of the Illuminati. I was approached January this year to join, and I had an application form. Yeah. I kept it, and I'm very happy at the break to share it with you so you can have a look. It was from one of the magical arms of the Illuminati, the non-satanic arm. Okay, here we go. Right, you may or may not know, I'm an elected Labour councillor in the town I live, and I was elected after I went public. Big problem for the people in power, because everybody was aware I come out on public with YouTube videos, the newspaper, and I was still elected. So that gives them a headache. I do confound it because the media, or some arms of the media, like to portray people who have alien experiences as half mad, running up and down the street, 2 o'clock in the morning. And when you see a guy in council meetings, some very important people, they can't square it. So I went public, Dave's right, but I went public a year before that. I went public in 2010 with YouTube videos. It was the back end of 11. That I went to the mainstream newspapers and did all that. The reason that I went public, for two reasons. One, I just felt that this is too big a truth. It just can't be hidden. And secondly, there are an awful lot of people out there who have experiences and have nowhere to talk to, nowhere to turn. And I thought, right, well, I'm not frightened. They can have my email address. And so during my talks, I actually put my email address up generally. So that's been wonderful because I've had people from all over the continent who've either flown just specifically to see me, or if they can't afford the flight, then they've Skyped me. A number of people who've been on the receiving end of the Illuminati with mind control have flown over where, and I don't charge for this, I don't like the word deprogramming, but there isn't another word for it, and I don't charge for that. Community. I've always had community jobs. I actually worked for the Natural History Museum in London. I was an auxiliary lecturer, and my job was to show kids all around the dinosaurs, the exhibits. I met children from all over the world who'd arrived by coach, meet them, take them around what we call the Earth Galleries. All my jobs have actually involved working with the community, and I think that's given me the strength to actually connect with people. Being a politician, the reason I joined the Labour Party and became into politics was because I saw kids in 1979 walking around with no shoes on their feet, and I just thought it wasn't right. I work, and my private life, married, got three children, and again, the system has a real problem because they like to show the people who have experiences as out-and-out loners, nobody wants them, living in squalor, etc., etc. So they have a real problem with me, and Dave's right, I do get it in the neck from the newspapers, but generally they do leave me alone. Okay, show of hands, who saw the Channel 4 documentary? Ooh, hands up already. Okay, a few of you. It was commissioned by an organisation called Off the Fence. Off the Fence were clearly designing the whole programme to be one of an entertainment show. And although I came out of it fairly less damaged than the others in terms of the attack, some of the other girls on that really, really went for them, and it was a disgrace. Okay, but what was removed, because the programme you saw wasn't really what went out, for about 40 minutes I was interviewed on the edge of MOD land with the Fylingdales radar, we'll talk about it later, behind me is a backdrop, and I was interviewed for about 40 minutes there. And about an hour in my own house regarding my mother's work with MI5, grandfather's work with MI6, and then I got a phone call saying that they were going to have to drop all that because they had been lent on. 4 days before the documentary went out, I got a phone call from the security officer at Fylingdales saying, "We're very unhappy, we've heard you've done a documentary, who's doing it?" It's at Channel 4. They made Channel 4 take out all of the footage of my interview with Fylingdales behind me, and the MOD made them take out all of the interview with me, with MI5 and MI6. The section where you might remember in my driving my 4x4 with an Audi car behind us, everybody thinks it was staged. It really wasn't. For 20 minutes after we'd done the filming outside the Fylingdales, we were followed by an Audi, and I turned to Guy, who was the cameraman, who actually did these Jamie Oliver school dinners. He was the director who did that. And I said, "Point your camera out the back, get that guy's registration number." Sorry, if you did see that, that gives you a bit more background onto it. Fylingdales. Anybody know Fylingdales? Anybody seen Fylingdales? A few people? Okay. All right. Originally, it's about 1992, the golf balls were an analog radar array. This was at Fylingdales. Three golf balls. It's been replaced by a phased array. It's the only one in the world. It's a three-faced looking radar. Three-faced. It's the only one in the world. It's called RAF Fylingdales. In actual fact, it's United States of America. We'll talk about that. They're very open. They say it's a space radar. A whistleblower about 5 years ago started using it, and they've not actually gone back on that. So they'll accept that as it's a space radar. So we'll have a closer look. That's one of the faces looking out. These are official slides from the MOD. Very kindly got them lent. So these are official slides. The official line is, this looks up 3,200 miles into space and detects any ballistic missiles that might be heading to America. The wall is called the fence. So this radar screen is known as the fence. And you can see there, Fylingdales is just marked. BMUs, Ballistic Missile Early Warning System. That's its official title. And there you can see a missile coming up to the right-hand side, Number two is the Fivendales detects it and an interceptor missile is launched and everything's jolly and dandy. Right, I wonder about how it came about. I don't have permission to talk about my daughter very much, but I will tell you that in a previous job she was approached by somebody who was an ex-serving member of the police force, who approached her at a presentation to work and said, I know what you and your father are looking for, I can get you into any secret base in the country. So she told me and said, Dad, you know, this sounds great. To which I replied, yeah, I've heard it all before, let's just ignore it. About a year later, I got an email from the base wanting my registration, I make a car, the colour, and it was arranged. So my daughter and I had a private tour of the Fivendales base. So we arrived at the main gate. My daughter lives in London and came up the day before. And as you know, these bases are guarded by Ministry of Defence police officers with fully machine guns, not just semi-automatic machine guns. They are designed to be fully automatic. And a guy comes up, I put the window down, and my daughter said her name, and then Simon Parks, we're here for the tour. And the guy said, just one word, ID. So she hands across her passport. He looks at the passport picture, looks at her, looks back at the passport picture, looks at her, says, okay. I go to give him mine, and he raises his hand and says, that won't be necessary. So I went in, second checkpoint, this time a woman with a list of names, her daughter went up, same thing. I went up, she couldn't even look at me. This woman just stared continually down on the desk. Fine? Okay. Got in. When you go in, you have a presentation, PowerPoint presentation, very much like the getting. But I spoke to two people, ex-military afterwards, who also had been on a tour there, and they said, I got a different tour. These are the slides that I got. During the presentation, the guy leading it showed a picture of a ballistic missile launch and said, we see these. And then he said, we see these. And then he said, we don't see these. And then he said, we sometimes see this. This was directly aimed at me. Please don't ask any questions at this tour. That's what he was saying to me. Don't ask any questions of any UFOs. We're not interested. But you know, the truth often comes out when they don't mean it. He could have shown any UFO. What he's actually shown is a picture of the alleged UFO from Area 51. Bob Lazar testified that he actually worked at Area 51, and that's actually called the sports model. So it's very interesting that they should show a picture of a craft that's supposed to come from Area 51. So anyway, we had that, and then we went round and we had our tour. At the end of the tour, it's 3 hours, it should only have been 1 hour, it was a 3 hour tour. At the end of it, he opened a cabinet and started giving out, you know, what people like little mementos, so key rings and fobs and pencils. And I went up to him and I looked on the back and there were some very nice coins, looked like coins, and I said, oh, they're very nice. And he said, oh, they are. He said, they're special, we give them as presentations. I can't, you know, can't like have them. So I said, oh, could you present me with one? So he looked at me and he said, well, I don't see why not. But he said, the Americans insist that I take your name. I said, you know my name. He said, yes, I know, but I have to take your name. So he said that each one, I brought it for you to have a look at. On one side it says the Royal Air Force, and on the other it's got the picture of the space radar. And they're numbered. So this is number 86 of a limited edition of 500, and the Americans now know that Simon Parks has 56. And it was commemorating 50 years of this base being operational. So he said, you've got to make a contribution. So I just had £10 in my pocket, gave him the £10. So I was presented with that. So you can have a look at that a bit later. One of the things that people wonder is, you know, I've come out and said my mum worked for MI5 and granddad MI6 and I have alien experiences. Yet here they are showing me around at a base. And I say to people, do you know, if I was making it up, if it was full of bullshit, they certainly wouldn't have me there. They knew all about me and who I was. And for the record, it's not run by the Royal Air Force. It is an American installation, and the Americans sit behind glass doors. Okay, on the left, of course, Fylingdales. On the right, this is Men with Hills. It's a listening post. It's also an American installation. Edward Snowden recently did a runner. He was the one that broke the news that the GCHQ spy on America and America spies on Britain. It's illegal in Britain, supposedly, to have your phones or your email tapped unless there's a court order. But it's perfectly legal for the American security services to read your emails because it's a foreign country. And this is what they do. They share each other, so they don't break any rules. And he actually came out and said it. In actual fact, Edward Snowden was one of the ones who was saying that the Russians were being particularly listened to, and Dmitry Medvedev, the Prime Minister of Russia, has actually ordered 12 1933 German typewriters and ordered his staff to stop using computers because they're so regularly hacked. They are now using typewriters. That's how bad it is. And also, the Guardian newspaper, their investigative journalist, is now using a 1938 typewriter because MI5... you may have read that MI5 and GCHQ went down and made them destroy all their hard drives that relating to certain things. So now they're using typewriters. Isn't it funny how things go around? But what's really crazy is that the Germans in the Second World War were fighting the Nazis, fighting the Russians, and now the Russians have German typewriters. Okay. On the left-hand side, the real brains and the real power behind the world, the National Security Agency, the NSA, more powerful than the CIA, and on the right-hand side, GCHQ. That's Britain's eavesdropping experts. On the left-hand side, a picture taken 9 months ago, and on the right-hand side, taken 4 months ago, Bluffdale. President Obama, 2 years ago, signed into office funding to allow the NSA to contain and record every email, every phone call, every piece of digital information sent in the world. Everything. The lot. Storing it here. Every piece of communication is going to be stored. People in Congress have asked why, and you can imagine the answer is just it's a national security thing. So we don't appear to have a free country here, we don't appear to have a free world. So quite simply, if we accept we are not free, then who's preventing us from being free, maybe? So I want to talk about the Illuminati. This is the term that's given generally, if you go on online, this is the name that everybody seems to identify with. It is actually a way of thinking, it's a way of acting, and it's a way of ruling. So we need to really start with who or what are the Illuminati. Your chairman on the page, on the website, BUFOG website, put up the all-seeing eye and the pyramid taken from the dollar. Has everybody seen one of those dollar bills? Yeah. Okay, it has to be pre-1969. I've brought one along. You can have a look. I've got a glass for you so you can have a little look through a magnifying glass. And see if you can spot the owl. There is a little owl hidden in there, which is the Illuminati symbol, and there's a little reptilian. So, no prizes, but see if you can spot that. Okay, how are the Illuminati structured? This is an old graph, but it's the best one that I can find. Starting on the left-hand side, you have from the original Bavarian Illuminati. And then moving to the centre, the novice witch at the bottom. You can tell that's a magical arm. Move across, you've got the military arm, the Knights Templar. And then a more of a military arm, but the one that involves politics. And on the right-hand side, you have the satanic arm. Okay, so you have the satanic side, and when people think that white is good, you have to understand that you can have pure evil. So to be dressed in white robes doesn't mean you're good. It means you're pure. You can be pure evil. So try and get away from the idea of the coloured robes. It doesn't mean anything. The approach I had could probably be something like the Rosicrucians, which is a non-satanic magical arm. Okay, so earlier this year, and I'm quite happy to let you look at it, you can't take pictures, you can't take it out, but you can have a look. The home of Freemasonry in Britain is Scotland, and this arrived for me with Scottish stamps on it, and it's entitled The Order of the Hidden Masters, and I'll just read you a front page. For those of you wondering why an application form, that's exactly what I said. Why a secret society and an application form? And the answer was, well, in your case, we think everybody needs to have it written down as to what's agreed so that nobody can go back on it on a later day. The logo is OHM, Order of the Hidden Masters. I'll just read this bit out. The Order of the Hidden Masters consists of a group of teachers and students who do not reveal their identities as members to the general public, or to their friends, or even amongst themselves. They work entirely in secret and may only mention the order to those whom they know to be worthy in every way in the manner explained hereafter. The only person who knows all of the teachers and the students is the Supreme Grand Master, the Hierophant, and he in turn is known only to those who serve on the Supreme Inner Council. This is the Illuminata. The ramifications of the order are worldwide, but none of the leaders have ever been discovered by the uninitiated anywhere. So I'm very happy for you to have a read of this. This was an approach made to me. They knew that I wouldn't bite on something that was satanic, so they sent something not satanic, but still I wasn't interested. The Illuminati consists of a whole range of people. Unfortunately, a lot of people write on the web and they don't know what they're writing. They're just rehashing, regurgitating. They say Rothschilds, Bilderbergers. What you must try and understand is it doesn't matter what organization or group you're in, it's who you are. You could be the caretaker, but you could be a member of the Illuminata. Because on a need-to-know basis, nine times out of ten, you wouldn't be the caretaker. What I'm trying to get across to you is that what they will do is place people into organizations. It's not the organizations that are Illuminati, it is the individual people that have been placed in there to gain control of those organizations. Right, we'll talk about my life growing up now. My grandfather. My grandfather used to speak publicly, in public in the sense that these were small gatherings. And one of his sayings was, the public can't even go to the toilet without our help. Okay, grandfather was very upper class, so it would be WC. The politician is only concerned with the next election, the diplomat with the next generation. By their nature, the politician is beholden to the public and must inform them, but the public must never know. They are incapable of making the right decisions. We do that for them. Getting the flavour of this now? Right, my grandfather, 1932, he went off to India, having served in the First World War as the youngest company sergeant major in the British Army. He was 18. So off to India in 1932, there was a demonstration and a riot, people in India trying to throw the British out, and he was quite instrumental in gaining control of this riot, and he was awarded the OBE medal. And with it went an appointment to join MI6. Now, people who genuinely have experience at the security services don't use the word MI6. I use the word MI6 because that's what you guys know. It's the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Services. By the late 1930s, it became MI6 as a sort of under the term name. Those of you who probably have heard this one, I'll just very quickly go over it. King Edward VIII, if you read the official histories, King Edward VIII had an affair with Wallace Simpson, and the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Prime Minister were so horrified because Wallace Simpson was a divorcee that they said to the King, well, you can't marry a divorcee, you'll have to resign or abdicate. And so the jolly old King abdicated. And that's what the history books will tell you, even now. What my grandfather said, and I think it's beginning to come out now, is that Wallace Simpson was having an affair with one of the attaches or the ambassador of the German embassy based in London, none other than a guy called von Ribbentrop. Von Ribbentrop had targeted her because she was also having an affair with the king, and the object was to do two things: one, to steal documents, and secondly, to try to circumvent Chamberlain so that Britain would not go to war with Germany and would stay neutral. And this is why Rudolf Hess flew, but that's another story anyway. So It got to the point where they had to confront the king and say, look, you know, we think you're going to have to stop this, and he refused point blank. So the Prime Minister turned to somebody in the Illuminati and said, what do I do? And he was told, form a jury of 12 good men and true, and then get them to vote on whether the king stays or goes. My grandfather was one of those 12 men. He was an Indian. And he said to me that he got a coded message which quite simply said, should the king go or stay? And I said to grandfather, well, what did you reply, grandfather? It was always grandfather, it was never granddad. He was very, very clear on that. And he said, I said the king had to go. So my next question was, what was the vote? And it was something along the lines of 10 voted for the king to go, 2 to stay. So the Prime Minister then felt that he had the strength of the country behind him, went to the king and said, you have to go. The king said, very well, because he wasn't going to fight the Illuminati. Very well, but I want to go on to BBC, the Home Service, and tell everybody what's happened here. And the Prime Minister said to him, I have given instructions that all the doors to the radio office are to be locked. You are not allowed to do any such thing. The king abdicated. That's the reality. That's what happened. And I always say this to people because I try to hammer it home. That was 1936. My grandfather was not elected by anybody. The king was not elected by anybody. So you have two unelected people making the decisions, and you or your family before you had no vote and say in the matter. That's 1936. So just imagine how sewn up tight it is now. Let's move on. He returned back to Britain from India, and he worked very hard to get America to come in on the war against Germany. I know war was before that, but that was a period of time that he was working hard. War was declared on the 3rd of September 1939. My grandfather was considered so important, they did not want him in London where a stray bomb might kill him, and they said, we have to get you out. Do you want to be an officer in the army, or do you want a political, a diplomatic position? He said, I'll take a diplomatic post. And he took a post as vice consul for the British Embassy in Pondicherry, which is in India. A destroyer was sent for him, and he went on a boat with a destroyer escort. And that was the 11th of September. So less than 1 week after Chamberlain said that Britain was at war, they got my grandfather out. Less than 1 week. When he arrived there, he demanded that his wife and 2 children should be brought to India, and another destroyer was dispatched, and they were then taken there. He was given an understrength platoon of Gurkha bodyguards. These were not to protect the British building, they would protect him. They were his bodyguards. And he was promoted to British consul. Why was he not the British ambassador? Because there's a standing rule in all countries that the ambassador is never involved in espionage. The ambassador must always be above it. But anybody below the ambassador can be a secret agent. And that's every country in the world follows that rule. Okay, after the war, India gained independence. My grandfather was posted to other countries, the United States of America, the Near and Far East, and France. And he met Stalin in 1947, and then he was awarded the MBE. He returned to the United Kingdom and was awarded the CBE, which he was very proud of as commander of the British Empire. He had a falling out with the British Prime Minister. Even now I can't tell you who that is, but they were falling out with him. And he was offered and accepted a diplomatic post as Britain's representative of the United Nations. So he went off to the UN. It was time to retire from diplomatic life, but he remained an active member of the SIS. Now, he was allowed to officially retire from the SIS in 1965. He was offered a knighthood to make him Sir James Owen Marsland. He went for a fitting of the gown, but he saw the emblem on the front of the gown. I've got a picture for you. And when he saw that, he just thought, well, that's New World Order. I'm not having that. And declined it. But he became a companion. He became a companion. And he was told, well, if I nip across, he was offered stocks and shares in Rolls Royce. He said, I don't want the motor car industry, there's no deal in that. I want the side that has the engines, Rolls Royce engines. And he went to Mappin & Webbs in Regent Street in London to choose any jewellery that he wanted. The reason for that was he was told that the British government was going to remove any record of him at all, which meant no state pension, no civil service pension, nothing. But he would have to survive on his stocks and shares. They didn't want him linked to the government at all. So we really can call him an illustrious grandfather. This is a painting of Edward VIII. He was very much the wayward king. He went to Wales and took pity on the miners, turned to politicians and said, why are these people living in poverty? What's going on in this country? And from that moment onwards, they didn't want him going and seeing ordinary people. Grandfather was always very annoyed because had he been in Britain when the vote was taken, he would have been given a coin penny in 1936. There's about 12 or 15 in the world made, and he said to me right back then it was worth £250,000. Each one of them who took part in that vote was given a memento of the fact. I've got the coin here, and it actually says Edward VIII on it. They were only minted in, I think, three mints, and in Britain, literally, what they did with them was given to whoever was voting here, and the rest was buried under buildings, Illuminati buildings. So wherever the cornerstone is, they stuck them under there. But you can have a look at the coin when we have a break. And here's the big reason. In 1937, there's the king, as he could have been, but of course he's just now plain old mister, and Wallace Simpson meeting Earl Fitler. And that's again why Hess flew to Britain, but we love that time of the day. Okay, I'm going to move across to that Ron. Very interesting, this. On the left-hand side is the Shah of Iran, and on the right-hand side, somebody you won't perhaps really have heard of, is Mohammad Mossadegh, who was Prime Minister from 1951 to 1953. Okay, did you know that in 1941, Great Britain and Russia invaded Iran to remove the then ruler and put the Shah into power? That's something that doesn't come out very much. In 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh was democratically elected as the Iranian Prime Minister. In 1953, he said to the Persian Anglo Oil Company, you're drilling all oil in our country and you're taking all the oil and you're not giving us any money. That doesn't seem fair to me. How about a 50-50 split? So the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which you now know as BP, said, well, we can't be having that. We can't be losing our profits. So they went to the CIA and said to the CIA, what can you do? And the CIA said, well, we're not going to do anything about it. They went to the Illuminati through MI6, my grandfather, who want this man removed. There was a change in American president at that time. I think it was possibly Eisenhower, to check that one out. There was a change in president. And the CIA, with MI6 backing, deposed Mohammad Mossadegh. And hey-ho, all the oil companies were denationalised and everything was hunky-dory. This is what you don't read about. So they got rid of him. He was democratically elected. Whatever you might think of Iran, the man was democratically elected but wanted something for the people of his country, and the shareholders weren't going to have that. You all know this man as Ayatollah Khomeini. His actual title is Imam Khomeini. The Secret Service had a number of attempts, had a number of opportunities to remove him and never did. He spent time in Turkey, a hell of a lot of time with Saddam Hussein, and then 3 to 4 months before he was due to take power when the Shah had been thrown out, he fled to France. Now my grandfather, who was about 82 or 83 at the time, got back in touch with the powers and said, let me go to France, I can convince the French to let a hit squad kill him. And they said, no, we can't do that because the French are very, very wobbly. We can't really afford that. And my grandfather was always adamant, up to the day he died, that that was the opportunity that had he been allowed, he would have wiped that man out. Now, when I stand here and talk about grandfather and mother, people say, well, prove it. Well, you don't, because you're aware, but there's an awful lot of people who say, prove it. I've been very lucky, I've got something. I want you to look at this. James Marsland, 11th of September 1933, this is from a ship's manifest. Sailing to Bombay, born in 1896. And here's the key, it says, occupation, vice consul. This man was real, he worked for the government, he had a diplomatic passport. The CBE medal looks like that. That's not his. I had to lift this off the internet. It was the one he was extremely proud of because it's for the empire. It was created for the empire. He declined the knighthood. The knighthood would have been under the order of St. Michael and St. George. You know who St. George is. Slays a dragon, doesn't he? That's what the gown would look like, and he had a fitting for it. But when you had a closer look at the emblem, that looks all right, doesn't it? There's a dragon or a reptile or the devil on the floor, and then there's an angel over the top, sort of holding it down, and it says a token of a better age. But my grandfather understood that to mean a new world order, and so he declined it. He didn't want to be beholden to them in that side of it. Grandfather was not a Satanist. Okay, let's talk about my mother. My mother worked for the British Security Service. You don't say MI5, you say BSS. Or verbally SS, which is a bit of a problem. So you could say that the British Security Service, very few people will write SS, for obvious reasons. My mother used to say the public can't be told about aliens, just look at Orson Welles and his H.G. Wells adaptation. If you're aware of that, there was a radio broadcast that went out, and it caused absolute panic in America, which Orson Welles narrated. My mother also said, if we're not there to hold their hands, what would the great unwashed do? Meaning the general public. And she said, they're all just children. They can't decide for themselves. Okay, so who's really calling the shots? We have the pyramid with a seeing eye, and it says there, UK intelligence, MI5. Yep, that's it. There's the pyramid with your seeing eye, so you really know who the Illuminati are, don't you? You haven't got the alien talk tonight, so you're not going to get too much. But my mother was told that because she was a British subject, she was managed by MI5, but in reality all her work was for the National Security Agency of America. So it was shared with Britain, but all her work was controlled by the National Security Agency, who are bigger than the CIA. People know the CIA, they don't know the NSA. All right, brief talk about my mother. My mother was a copy typist. In the solicitors in Hove from 1962 to 1963. And that meant that she typed complex documents. Could be land registry, could be buildings, could be anything. But they would be complex, they wouldn't be just straightforward. From 1964 to 1979, she held the title of Special Projects Typist. Now that sounds really, really... What it actually means is, when somebody came in with an invention, she would be the person who typed it up. So a patent office is where you patent your invention. You invent something, could be a board game, could be a new combustion engine. You go in and you say, has anybody made this before? You pay whatever it is you pay, they check it. No, this is new. And so you patent it in your name. It becomes your product and you can then sell it. So between 1964 and 1979, she was Special Projects Typist. However, between 1966 and 1979, she worked for the British Security Services, working from home. She signed the Official Secrets Act sometime in the mid-1960s. Sometime in the mid-1960s. I can't remember exactly when. So, very briefly, talk about the day-to-day work. Forgive me if you've seen this on one of my YouTube videos, but it's really important and it's worth going through. A guy with a false name, and the name he gave us was Paul Dunlop, would turn up with documents which were cream-coloured, bigger than A4, all in German, with the German eagle on the front. West German, in those days, West German Republic. Lovely seals in wax on the front, and he would hand it to my mother, take a small penknife from his pocket, cut the ribbon, which secured from one seal to the other around the front, signed or initialed the top right-hand corner. My mother took it and signed her name on the top right-hand corner. That document was now her property. With it, he gave her a spool of tape. And he had read through the documents and read a sentence at a time, one sentence in German, then in English. Her job was to put earphones in, advance the tape, hear one sentence, and type it out in English. These documents were from about 5 pages thick to about 15, 16 pages thick. Not huge documents. They contained blueprints, and I remember as a boy, putting your hand on it, and you get blue, like blue ink all over your hand. Some of the paper was thin as onion skins. All had drawings, designs, but all in German, not in English at all. All these documents related to crashed craft, crashed UFOs that had come down on the Earth. The documents never said how they'd been brought down, where they'd come down, or the date. The format was always the same. We've got this piece of machinery. What can you do with it? How can you develop it for us? And it just felt each document, each time she got one, just followed the same format. On the top, in red ink, was either the words secret, top secret, very top secret, or in purple ink, extremely top secret. And she worked on these for maybe 4, 5, 6 days. If it was a short document, maybe a fortnight, it was a big document. And she would walk out of the house and a green Jaguar would wait for her. She would pass code words with the front passenger, get into the back seat. And the back seat was a copy of the Financial Times. She'd put her typed document into the Financial Times, be driven to Brighton Railway Station, and she'd buy a platform ticket for 2p. She'd go and sit on the London-bound platform, and a guy would go out, bowler hat, red coronation, pinstripe suit, suitcase, umbrella, copy the Financial Times under his arm, sit next to my mother, and they would pass code words. He would give her his copy of the Financial Times, she would give her his, with the documents in it. He'd get back on the train, off he went. Why did my mother join the Secret Service? Because she was a single parent, and she had one wage, which she had from the Patent Office. And the deal was that she would get two wages. So in actual fact, what happened was that she was told that every Friday at 3:30 she had to walk to her office, where she would go to reception, she would sign her name, and she would be given her wages. She didn't have to do a day's work there. She didn't actually have to work there. She was being paid by these people on a weekly basis for nothing, and on a monthly basis, then Paul Dunlop would come and then he would pay her. And she was told that that job was there for her whenever she wanted. In other words, they promised her that if she wanted to leave at any time, she could, and she was even shown by the manager, or one of the partners, I should say, there's your chair, there's your typewriter, and there's your desk. And nobody will sit in there, and if you're 5 years, 10 years, 15 years away from us, don't worry about it, that job is yours when you come back. So that's what she did. Mother didn't drive, and they offered her a motor car, and she said, no, not really, and they just said, well, would the boy like me? Well, yes, please. I've got lots of presents like that. In 1979, she became an alcoholic because she couldn't cope with what she was reading. It became too much. Also, she was very loyal to this country. She didn't talk to anybody. She didn't discuss it. And for those years, reading and understanding at the level of which she was reading and understanding just became too much. So she went to her handlers and said, I've had enough. I want my old job back. You promised it to me. And they were as good as gold. They gave her a job back, and then 2 weeks later she was dead. Died of a heart attack. But the underlying story there is my mother had asthma. And I know this sounds very naive, but sometimes people aren't always in their right mind around security service. She met a man who she'd never met before, who convinced her to drink herbal medicine to make her asthma better. And she used to come back with these bottles. So 2 weeks later she was dead. And in fact, I don't mind admitting I was really upset. I was really sort of cut up about it, and I wanted to leave Brighton and start afresh, go to London, get a job in London. And I think it was the day before I was due to leave, an envelope came through the door with a couple of £1,000 in news notes and just a typed note which said, don't look back, Dick Whittington. So that was another present they gave me. I understand why they did it, because she was a loose cannon. they had no alternative, because from their point of view, she had all this knowledge and they'd lost control of her. So that's from their point of view. Let's talk about some of the work she did. We talk about German documents on Operation Paperclip, which I'm sure most of you will have heard of. It's where the Americans forgave the Nazi scientists their crimes and said, you know, come to America and we'll look after you. What my grandfather told me was that in 1945, as parts of Germany were falling under the Allied hands, the Americans became more and more gobsmacked at what they were finding, and they altered their plans. Those members of the Secret Service in America who were looking for war criminals were told, forget that, start rounding up scientists. So I want to have a quick look at this guy. This guy at the front is Hermann Oberth. And the guy... That one there is Werner von Braun, who joined what became NASA and helped to invent the Saturn V rocket. In 1972, Hermann Oberth actually made a statement, and I'll just read it out to you. It's very interesting. People say there's no evidence out there. Hermann Oberth, we can't take credit. This is the Nazis, not America. We can't take credit for our record advancement in certain scientific fields alone. We have been helped, and we have been helped by the people of other worlds. And he said that in 1972. And it was von Braun who was taken to the Roswell crash site, and one of the American intelligence guys said to him, this reminds me of an aeroplane. And von Braun said, well, you know, we did get help, you know. So in other words, two top German scientists who ended up working for NASA both declared that extraterrestrial, I'm going to use that word at the moment, extraterrestrial intervention helps Germany technologically to get the march on every other country in the world. And this is the plane. On the left-hand side is good old Kenneth, who saw some UFOs early 1947. And at a later date, he did a drawing of this one. And the resemblance to the Gopher Go 229 in its tail is remarkable. It doesn't mean necessarily that UFOs were copied from German aircraft. My understanding is that the Germans were trying to create aircraft similar to what they were seeing, but they had to use traditional jet engines. Roswell, you're all familiar with Roswell. You can't hear being Bufog and not. So I'm going to whip through this because you're going to know more than I will. There's your newspaper heading. The intelligence office, Jesse Marcel, told the world that a flying saucer had been captured. RAAF is Roswell Army Air Field. And told them they'd captured it and it was going to be sent off to higher headquarters. That's all they were told. Everything else was about witnesses, etc., etc. That's Jesse Marcel. If you ever see a man lying, look at his eyes. I feel for that man. Here he is sitting in General Roger Ramey's office with what's very clearly a meteorological balloon and trying to pass that off as the wreckage that was found and sent off. Anybody who would think that a major in the counterintelligence, that's the job Jesse Marcel had, couldn't tell the difference between a wrecked weather balloon and alien spacecraft, he just needs a head examining. This man would not have sent pieces of weather balloon up to higher headquarters. On the left-hand side is General Roger Ramey, and on the right-hand side is Adjutant Colonel Du Bois. Roger Ramey is holding in his hand a telegram. That's interesting. Lots of pictures of telegram. Back in 1947, if you were standing 12 feet away from somebody, there's no way you could read that telegram. And if you were taking photographs, there was no way you could do that. He wouldn't have known that many, many years later, with digital technology, it would be possible to read that telegram. Think how many government ministers have lost their job going into 10 Downing Street because they've held their briefing papers the wrong way up, and then the score of pressmen and women over there photographing them, and then the world knows about it before they've even talked about the Parliament. That's why they always carry their papers towards their chest or in a case. But back in 1947, that wasn't possible, was it? But of course it is, because that's good enough to stick through software and have those words interpreted. I'm sure you've all seen this, but just in case any of you haven't, let's read it out. It's a bit jumbled. So, acknowledges that a disk is the next new find west of the corner. That location was a wreck near the operation. It says, and in addition, there's a few words missing, it uses the word pod and airfoil. And it says, the ranch and the victims of the wreck you forwarded to the, it'd be the CIC team at Fort Worth. The aviators in the disk